The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday the 13th, 2007. That's lucky Friday the 13th. And this is episode number 86. Thank you very much for downloading the show. I'm Bob Hayes, your host here today, as I am every week, to present the latest and greatest in MotoGP news for your listening pleasure. First off, I'd like to say a big, huge thank you to some people here that responded to last week's call for donations. Carlton DeVillier, Charles Clark, Abhe Vaze, or Abhe Vaze, Daniel Prajansky, and Clark Bell all very generously donated to the MotoGPOD cause, which helped a lot, should keep the bandwidth and telephone bills and whatnot paid for about another month and a half or so. Do appreciate that. And speaking of telephone calls, we've got a call with Liam coming up here a little bit later in the show. And along that, we have our Sachsenring preview. And we're going to be talking a little bit about some stuff that's coming up in the news. So we've got a few things going on. Before we get to all of that, I'd like to mention a few other things. Like I said, first of all, thank you very much for those donations. I really appreciate it. MotoGPOD's cupboards were getting pretty bare there for a while. And I was starting to have to think of getting a second job or something. I don't know. Next up, don't forget that the Sachsenring race, for those of you in the United States that want to watch it on television, Sachsenring is also going to be on CBS. So did CBS listen to last week's round two of the Pepsi Challenge? I don't know. We're going to have to find out. We'll see if they listen to our pointers and complaints and whining or not. We did get a lot of email about that. Apparently people liked the Pepsi Challenge the second time around too, so I'm glad you did. Thanks a lot for all the emails that we received. And we've got a link that I found on Ride On 2 on the forums on rideon2.com in the everything else section. And it was posted by John with no last name, unfortunately, but he's AKA Trials Tech is his forum name on Ride On 2. And his link for the MotoGP bingo is at egreendata.com/MotoGP/bingo.php. And of course, I'm going to put that link on the website so you don't have to worry about remembering it right now, or actually go to rideon2.com and find the topic, which is MotoGP bingo, in their everything else section. And take a look at this because it's really, really cool. And you probably heard of, when you have like office meetings or something and you do buzzword bingo or whatever, where you have bingo and whoever marks when you hear the certain word, you know, and then you get bingo. So this is the same kind of topic for MotoGP. So he's got all kinds of cool stuff on here, and it's half joking and half serious, where, you know, we see things like in here that some of the bingo items are dry race or wet race or first rider crashes out or things, Michelin wins and stuff like that. But some of the sort of lighter hearted tongue in cheek things are awesome. And Schwantz says just, or we say Vermeulen wears a floppy hat. The one I like a lot here is, Rossi picks butt, Uccio holds earplugs, you know, stuff like that. So when you see or hear those topics come up, you mark bingo on there, and the first person to get a bingo on the card wins the game. I think that's great fun. If you happen to watch MotoGP with a couple of friends, you can download a MotoGP bingo card and play along. That's good stuff. Next up, Darren Carpenter, longtime listener of MotoGP.OD, has announced that it's a big event at the Portland International Raceway this weekend. So if you happen to live in the Northwest and you can get to the Portland Raceway this weekend, OMRA races there are going to be big, big stuff. We've got Vintage Racing, USGPRU, the U.S. Grand Prix Racing Union racing is there at the OMRA, the only official recognized motorcycle 125 Grand Prix National Championship and the 250 Grand Prix National Championship Series, because AMA doesn't race the 250s anymore. That allows the young riders the opportunity to get world-class racing experience. And yada, yada, yada. Second, Elena Myers is the 13-year-old racer who is also going to be up there in Portland this weekend. She's got her expert license with OMRA last year, and she's been ripping up the track ever since. If you want a role model for your daughters, who better than a little girl who beats all the boys and men on the track? And third, and this is going to be the big draw, The Red Bull Factory Yamaha riders Eric Bostrom and Ben Bostrom are scheduled for July 15th at Portland International Raceway for the Omer Race Weekend. They won't be racing, but they'll be helping out on the track and in the classroom for the USGPRU Apex Academy, and they'll be in the pits for photos and autographs and all kinds of stuff. Also, Doug Chandler set a new track record at Omer racing NFS Superbike, and he's planning on racing this weekend, so expect that the track record will be broken once again. So whatever, sounds like a huge weekend at PIR. So if you're in the Northwest, consider going. It's going to be good fun. And last little tidbit before we get to the main meat of the show is don't forget about that Nikki Hayden banner auction. I told you about it last week. The Nikki Hayden fan suite banner is going to be auctioned off to benefit the Road Racing World Action Fund, which pays for air fencing at racetracks in the United States, and the Red Flag Fund, which helps pay for injured riders, medical bills and expenses and so forth. And I just want to mention it again real quick. Steve Jones put a few more details on the USMotoGPFans.com website. That's USMotoGPFans.com. And let's see, he says the 2007 banner will be unveiled on the Nikki Hayden fans suite at 9:55 a.m. Friday, July 20th, just before MotoGP free practice session number one. The one-of-a-kind original banner celebrating Nikki Hayden's MotoGP World Championship will be signed by the world champion himself. The eBay auction will start at 7 p.m. Pacific time on Thursday, July 19th, and it will run for 10 days, ending on Sunday evening, July 29th. There's going to be a link, or there is a link now, to the auction at usmotogpfans.com, but that link will not work until the auction actually starts on July 19th. As I record this, I think that Steve Jones is actually on his way riding from, Kansas or wherever it is that he lives, all the way across country to get to Laguna Seca for this for next weekend's Laguna Seca round of the US MotoGP. So he had to do a lot of preparation ahead of time of putting up links and things like that that aren't quite ready yet. But they're there at usmotogpfans.com. These are two excellent charities, very worthy causes. So if this is the kind of thing that you like, I encourage you to take a look at the auction and consider making a bid and bid often. All right, now we've got enough of that pre-show chatter out of the way. Why don't we get on to hearing some news? Like I said in today's intro, this past week has been big for news of MotoGP. We've had quite a few large stories breaking, and so let's cover a couple of those ones that just came out recently here. The first off is that it looks like MotoGP is going to have a race at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in 2008. Now, it's not truly official yet, but an announcement is expected to be made next week, on July 16th to be exact, and it looks like the Eastern United States Grand Prix, or whatever they're going to call it, will be held in September, mid-September, and get this, it's going to include the 125 and the 250cc classes, which we have not had at Laguna Seca, so that's always kind of a bummer that we miss out on the 125s and the 250s, so it looks like they're going to be going to Indianapolis. However, real quick to digress slightly from MotoGP and to pass on a news item that has been announced and is official, and that is that Formula One will not be returning to the Brickyard in 2008, which is a big old bummer. But Formula One is not the focus of this show. MotoGP is. And so we do still have that question of MotoGP returning to Laguna Seca next year. Will they come back? I meant to mention this one last week, but I kind of spaced it. But the July issue of Motorcyclist magazine had a column by editor Brian Catterson where he sort of addressed this whole issue. And some of the points that he made, we're talking about use the old baseball adage, three strikes and you're out applies. This is the make or break year for the U.S. Grand Prix. So despite the fact that the 2007 event will be only the third in a five-year contract, it could possibly be the last. Supposedly, Dorna and the FIM have told Laguna Seca's promoters that they need to put on a world-class event this year or else. Because, unfortunately, despite being located in the richest country on Earth, Laguna Seca is one of MotoGP's poorest venues, paling in comparison to sparkling new facilities in supposedly third-world countries such as China, Malaysia, Turkey, and Qatar. I would not call Qatar a third-world country, by the way. They are filthy rich. So, will MotoGP be back to Laguna Seca? I certainly hope so, but apparently it is not a done deal. Right now, in a nutshell, it looks like they will come back to Laguna Seca, but like I said, it's not a done deal at this point. There's, you know, and I've said this one before, and I'll say it again. I'm not really super enthusiastic about MotoGP having a race at Indianapolis, and I certainly don't want to see us lose our Laguna Seca round in order just to go to Indianapolis. Wouldn't mind having a second round in America, and if that second round has to be at Indianapolis, well, that's one thing. The problem with Indianapolis is it might very well be an excellent venue for a race, with their, you know, huge amounts of experience hosting large events and big track facilities and all this kind of thing. But the track itself is just is crap. Formula One ran clockwise on the circuit, but using one of the oval, the last turn one of the Indianapolis oval, which I think Formula One called turn 11, and they used that turn there. Combined with a dead, flat, uninspiring infield sort of road course. But that banked turn with its, you know, nice, friendly concrete wall right there is not a good thing for motorcycle racing. However, according to Catterson, a possible solution is running counterclockwise and redesigning that infield section to avoid the banking. So we're going to have to see what actually happens. But long story short, I would much rather see this second MotoGP event in the United States to be at a real road course. There's quite a few possible candidates, but the problem is I don't know that any of them are all that likely possibilities. Barber Motorsports Park in Alabama would be excellent, but it's too short, so it would need to be lengthened. Road America would be a possibility, and I don't really see why Watkins Glen couldn't do it as well. Mid-Ohio is crap, so they're not going to be there. But, you know, there's quite a few other possibilities of road courses east of the Mississippi where they could do it. But for one reason or another, they none of these are going to be hosting a round of MotoGP. Indy is going to be doing it. Now, like I said, Indy, excellent venue, and they'll probably get a pretty decent crowd. But you're going to see, you know, huge amounts of empty stands because, I mean, the place holds just enormous amounts of people. And they're not going to be filling up those stands for a MotoGP race, no matter how much they try. So, I don't know. We'll just have to see how that one turns out. If we do keep the round at Laguna Seca and we add Indy, this means that we're either going to have 19 races next year, which I kind of doubt they're going to go up to 19. That's a fairly busy schedule for the teams. I'd love to see it personally because 19 races is even more than 18, right? But more likely possibility is that we're going to lose one of the existing tracks, which it's probably going to be either Turkey or China. Kind of rumor has it right now that it's probably Turkey, and I'd really hate to see Turkey go because it's by far the coolest of the new super circuits designed by Herman Tilke of Formula One. And I mean, Turkey's got a lot of character going on, whereas China is somewhat classic Herman Tilke of relatively boring, plus being designed to look like a Chinese character. It's not that great a track, let's face facts. So, you know, if they had to get rid of one or another, I'd say, you know, lose China, lose Qatar, and I guess I'd get over it, but I'll be very sorely disappointed if they lose Turkey. So, next news item that we've got, it is official. Hopkins is going to Kawasaki for 2008. Kawasaki issued a press release on Thursday, July 12th, telling us that Hopkins has signed for next year. Said press release says all kinds of interesting things, mostly that Hopkins is going to Kawasaki. The Kawasaki racing team can confirm that John Hopkins will be one of the riders who will spearhead Kawasaki's assault on the 2008 MotoGP World Championship. With his name at the top of most team managers' wish lists. I like that one. That's a good quote machine line. Hopkins turned down a number of lucrative offers from other teams in order to sign with Kawasaki. Blah, 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 blah. And, you know, some other good stuff. Hopkins will at last be able to fully realize his considerable talents aboard Kawasaki's rapidly evolving and improving ZXRR. Yeah. So, I personally think that this is an enormous mistake for Hopper. I know that money's got to be involved. It's mostly about money. But this guy, Hopkins, had a really good thing going at Suzuki, and I think it somewhat took them, maybe not so much by surprise, but that Suzuki is somewhat disappointed about it. So, you know, and unless there's a whole lot of inside stuff going on within the Suzuki team that you're not really hearing about, it's not like the wisest long-term decision for Hopkins other than the money, which, and I'm not saying in the same position that I'm, you know, hey, money's a huge factor. You know, if these guys are going to be out there, they might as well keep getting paid as much money as possible for it. Right. But if Hopkins wants to sort of go down in the record books as, you know, having actually won a MotoGP race and these sorts of things, Kawasaki may not necessarily be the best choice. But rumors abound that Suzuki would not or could not meet Hopkins' asking price, which is $5.5 million. So, you know, it's always hard to find out what these guys are actually making money wise. And $5.5 million is a lot of money in anyone's book, except perhaps Rossi's. But I think that Hopkins may well have traded his shot at winning a MotoGP round for the big bucks. Kawasaki also says that they might sign a second big name. And Loris Caporossi has said that he's had an offer from Kawasaki, so he's the most likely candidate to be that big name, I think, at this point. And which kind of sucks for DePugna and West, who are being left out in the cold on this one. But you never know how things are going to shape up. Both of them. I mean, DePugna has done quite well at this season so far in the five races that he's finished on. It's just that he's crashed out of four of them. So hopefully he'll continue to improve and whatnot. Plus, Anthony West has done well at the two races he's done, and he may very well manage to make things look better. But Kawasaki is expected to announce their actual full lineup for 2008 very shortly here, sometime after Laguna Seca, they're saying that. Now, they have said that they may possibly run a third bike next season. So, you know, who knows? It might be DePugna or Anthony West that gets one of those rides. Speaking of Anthony West, I got an email from Terry James who said, if Anth West fell in the woods and Nick Harris didn't talk about it, would it make a sound? Which I thought was hilarious. It was kind of painful, but nonetheless quite funny. But in any event, silly season's just in full swing here going on. We have all kinds of stuff, and it's just sort of interesting to see what's going on. So we're going to wait for Kawasaki's press release about their rider lineup. That's coming up soon. But their press release machine over there at Kawasaki has been very busy because they also issued a press release that none other than Roger Lee Hayden, brother to Nicky Hayden, is going to be getting a wild card entry on the ZXRR at Laguna Seca. So it's going to be family reunion time, although I doubt that we're actually going to be seeing a whole lot of battle between Nicky and Roger because Nicky will be way out ahead of Roger. If we are lucky, though, we'll get to see some action between Roger and Miguel, as in Miguel Duhamel, who has been officially confirmed to ride for the injured Tony Elias on the Gresini Honda. Now, Michel Fabricio is going to be riding for Elias at the Sachsenring race, which hopefully he'll do better than when he replaced Elias back in 2006 for the Donington round and crashed and broke his collarbone during a practice session and didn't even get to race. So, and last thing, while we're talking about silly season silliness and Honda Gresini and all this stuff, it's probably a good time to mention that Marco Melandri is rumored to be leaving Honda Gresini and going to the factory Ducati team next year. So does this mean that Casey Stoner is going to have a different teammate to humiliate next year? Most likely because of the rumors that we've heard from Loris Caporossi possibly going to Kawasaki. So we'll just have to see. Speaking of teammates, rumors are still flying about Jorge Lorenzo from 250cc moving up and getting Colin Edwards' Yamaha seat. So now Colin could be that unlucky guy in the game of musical chairs who's going to get left out unless he can find a different ride somewhere else. I have my own opinions about that, and I think that Valentino Rossi, who holds considerable influence in the Yamaha team, really likes Colin Edwards as a teammate, so whether or not Lorenzo actually moves up does remain to be seen. Yamaha may not want to let him go, but they may also want to keep Rossi happy and they don't really have a good satellite team to put him on, but they may work something out. So I wouldn't rule Edwards out yet for the losing seat in musical chairs. But again, it all remains to be seen, and it gives us something here at MotoGPOD, something to talk about later on in the season when things we have that summer break or everything, or possibly even after the season. So that's the news for this week. Now let's do a Sachsenring preview, and I want to give extra special thanks to David Emmett of Kropotkin Thinks fame for giving me permission, very kind permission, to use his Sachsenring preview. This is from his blog at MotoGPMatters.com. And if you don't go to MotoGP Matters, I do encourage you to do so. This particular piece, I had to edit down considerably, not because it was bad or anything like that, but just simply for length. So if you like what you hear on this little piece, I go take a look at the real thing up there at MotoGPMatters.com. That's David Emmett's blog all about MotoGP. It's great stuff. David's a fantastic writer, and I know how much time it takes to prepare and to write stories like David writes, and I'm just wondering, frankly, where he gets all the time. So it's really good stuff, and why don't we get into it here? So David writes, "It is perhaps an interesting irony that the MotoGP circus moves from one former street circuit to another this weekend, leaving the fast, flat, sweeping turns of Assen behind to visit the tight, tortuous turns of the Sachsenring circuit. But where Assen's transformation from public roads to closed racetrack was a long process of sections being removed piece by piece in the form of death by a thousand cuts, the Sachsenring sprang fully formed from the brow of the ADAC, the German Automobile Organization, rising from the ashes of the legendary but deadly street circuit, which was finally killed off after three riders lost their lives there in 1990. The old road circuit was discarded, and over a period of 3 years, a new circuit arose around the ADAC Traffic Safety Center. The new track was the polar opposite of the old street circuit, not just safer, with plenty of runoff, but also much, much slower, with no more high-speed stretches chasing between tree-lined avenues and through villages. The new Sachsenring was a tight, swooping affair with few straights and long, slow corners. Most emblematic of this change was the Castrol Omega corner, which is a right-hander looping through almost 270 degrees before cutting back to start on an seemingly endless series of left-hand turns running out eventually onto the back straight. But despite its tightness, or perhaps because of it, the Sachsenring sees some incredibly close racing, with a margin of victory under 1 second in all but two of the nine premier class races held here so far, the difference within 1/10 of a second at a couple of those races. For the track really rewards guts, determination, and a willingness to stuff the bike inside or outside on lines that don't appear to exist. The track is relatively wide, and with a lot of turns leading into one another, it allows a brave, or perhaps wily, rider to vary his lines and run up against inside one section of the Omega, or perhaps outside through turn four to cut inside at turn five. But the main passing spot is turn 13, the Sachsenkurve. At the end of the back straight, where the 990s momentarily grabbed sixth gear before getting hard on the brakes at the bottom of the hill, competition for the inside line is fierce, as the first person through here is the first person into turn 14, and therefore usually the winner of the race. Knowing that this is where to pass doesn't make it any easier, though. Running downhill and braking hard puts enormous pressure on the front end, and mistakes here are punished mercilessly, leaving you dumped in the gravel. Another peculiarity of the Sachsenring is that it runs counterclockwise, and if there's one man in the field who excels at going fast and turning left, it is the reigning world champion Nicky Hayden. Hayden loves counterclockwise tracks, and he always goes well at them, and the Sachsenring MotoGP round comes at exactly the right time for him as he has finally started to gel with the Honda RC212V. So, a reinvigorated Nicky Hayden could be Honda's best hope of averting utter humiliation. The Japanese giant has now been 10 races without a win, which equals their longest streak in the premier class since entering the series in 1982. A Honda has not won a MotoGP race since Tony Elias took his debut win at Estoril last year, and the factory Repsol Honda squad has not won a race for almost a year since Nicky Hayden won at Laguna Seca in 2006. HRC are taking this very seriously indeed, with engineers working day and night to remedy the mistakes they made when designing the RC212V, but real updates will only come at Brno in August, which is still three races away. Bridgestone is hoping to break their own jinx at the Sachsenring circuit, because a Bridgestone rider has never finished higher than fifth place here in Germany. But this should be the season where that is going to change. Bridgestone has benefited hugely from the new tire rules, with tire selection on Thursday matching their existing way of working, where unlike Michelin, which would create tires the night before the race, so we can no longer rule out the Bridgestone riders just based on their tires alone. Bridgestone's best bet of a race win will surely be Casey Stoner. You know, conventional wisdom has it that the Sachsenring does not suit the nature of the Ducati, the track being way too tight for the Ducati to stretch its legs. But we've been saying that same thing at a number of tracks now, and we keep on being proved wrong, as whether the tracks suit the Ducati or not, they always seem to suit Casey Stoner. The young Australian is having as close to a perfect season as possible, already taking victory in 5 of the first 9 races. Whichever track MotoGP visits, Stoner has to be considered a factor. And if he can win at Donington, he can win just about anywhere. Another man almost guaranteed to provide spectacle at the Sachsenring is Valentino Rossi. Il Dottore has won here 4 times already, and even when he hasn't won, he has come tantalizingly close. Adding to the show is Rossi's position in the championship. Despite closing the gap on Casey Stoner at Assen, Rossi is still 21 points behind Stoner and having to fight tooth and nail for every extra point. The doctor is a lot closer to Stoner than he was to Nicky Hayden at the same point last year, but Stoner is arguably a much tougher opponent. Rossi will have to pull out all the stops to claw back the points that he needs to from the Australian, and his fight will start here at the Sachsenring. So, the Sachsenring MotoGP round, like the USGP at Laguna Seca to follow, comes at the perfect time to ensure that MotoGP fans get the epic show they both desire and deserve. With 2 riders engaged in close combat for the world championship, a major manufacturer desperate to avoid the humiliation of breaking their winless streak record, and a host of riders suddenly left looking vulnerable as the teams embark on an unusually early frenzy of rider swapping and silliness in the silly season, a lot of people have an awful lot at stake here in Germany. At a track where the racing is rarely anything other than extremely close, the Sachsenring looks sure to produce fireworks come Sunday. So, like I said, thank you very much to David Emmett, and you can read that full story at MotoGPMatters.com, and I encourage you to take a look, MotoGPMatters.com. Well, hello, Liam. How are you doing? Welcome to MotoGPOD.
Hi, everybody. Great to talk to you again, Bob.
Good. It's always good to talk to you. It's been a little while. We've had a couple of races back-to-back there. You did Donington and Assen, and mixed results at both, but certainly not too bad. But why don't anything sort of special? Why don't we talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think the bottom line is, compared to last year, every result we're getting this year is a bonus. You know, last year we were scrambling 14, 15, 17, really on the back foot of everybody. You know, we just hoping to edge out, you know, one of the Dunlop Yamahas. It was between Dunlop Yamaha and us. This year, we definitely got better material, and you know, Donington and Assen, kind of anticlimactic races because of all the strange weather conditions and switching bike setups between, you know, morning and the afternoon, or the race was going to be wet and it dried out. Really strange races in my mind, because there's so much tension that goes into it, especially with the weather adding a lot of stress. And then the race plays out and, you know, the gaps stretch out between the riders, and you're like, well, geez, you got 30 seconds on the guy behind you. Like, you know, don't worry about it. Or, you know, it was just kind of odd races in my mind. But we got top tens in both races with a 7 and a 9 in Donington and a 7-8 in Assen. Actually gifted when Depounier pulled a Depounier and to cut Vermeulen, which I really feel bad for Chris on that one, because the kid is such a good worker and a hard worker, and I really like his attitude around the paddock and around everybody. It's disheartening when you see a rider get taken out when you know he could have been a factor, and it happened to him several times this year. It happened to Barros when we were looking to really have a good result in China, when the bike was working good and he had such a great race pace. You know, when he got mixed, well, no, that's the wrong race. Anyway, he got into a mix-up with Elias and Hayden and ran off track. But, so I know what it's like when you kind of feel your race gets stolen from you, you know, even though it's inadvertent, you know, and no rider intentionally wants to take out another rider. It just, you know, it's racing and incidents happen. But, yeah, Donington and Assen. Yeah, solid results for the riders. I mean, the people that beat us were all factory teams, for the most part. Well, you know, yeah, I got to figure that there's 2 factory Suzukis that are working really well. You got really hungry riders that can run in the dry and the wet. Repsol seemed to have found a great resurgence in the competitiveness of their machines. After Catalunya, Nicky really made a big step forward. I think more than the revised chassis, I think giving him more control of the vehicle by detuning the traction control really is helping him and helping him mentally ride around the vehicle. I mean, because now, you know, he can steer with the rear again, and he can make that bike dance through the corners like he wants to. So I think he made a great step forward. The fact that both Repsol bikes came in third and fourth in the last race showed that their level is definitely up there now. And then, naturally, the Yamahas work really well, and the factory Ducati works great with Stoner. So the people that are beating us are, you know, on the level. We're not getting beaten by people that shouldn't be up there. We're as competitive as we can be right now, and naturally, we're always working to be more competitive. You know, we want to be on the sharp end, inside the top five, not battling around from fifth through tenth. But if you know, at the end of the day, if you told me, well, 1 year ago, you know, you got a 14 and a 16, and, you know, we're lucky to finish the race, and you told me this year that consistently we'd be, you know, I'd have a rider in the top 10 in the world standings, I probably wouldn't have believed you, and I'm happy for that, my riders can go out there and they have a chance of getting in the top 10. And then when conditions are right and everything's working, you know, they can break the top five, because we've done it three times this year, and I think we can do it again. We have a couple of tracks towards the tail end of the season where I think we're going to do really well, Motegi being one of them and Estoril being another. So we gradually work towards those, and we just try and make sure our bike is as prepared and ready to go at each racetrack we go to. I think Hoffman might surprise some people at Laguna, because he really, really likes that racetrack, and if the Bridgestones are working there, then it's going to be a great race for everybody. Same thing for Sachsenring. I mean, maybe we didn't have the race we wanted in Assen after the good times he posted in qualifying and in warm-up. But, you know, that's his home race in Sachsenring upcoming. So I think there's some extra motivation there for him to do well in that race.
Yeah,
plus,
yeah, I agree.
Everyone wants to get to these next two races so that we can get to our summer break.
Is that the official feeling on the teams? Just can't wait for the summer break?
Well, it's not we just can't wait. It's just that the reality is everybody's kind of run down.
Sure.
I mean, I know my chief mechanic is mountain biking in the mountains of northern Italy right now, and other people are exercising. That seems to be the best way to recharge the batteries because, you know, we're on the road so much, and you're in hotels and at the racetrack, and in hotels and at the racetrack. You know, when we get away from that, we try and you know, get outdoors and do something physical and get some body health back. You know, I know other teammates are having fun, but, you know, then there's guys like me that are more in logistics and more of a backbone that just have to keep chugging away every day. I don't have as much opportunity to travel between races or you know, go away for an entire day and not check my email and not stay on top of things.
But yeah, I mean, it's understandable. I mean, you get these races back to back. That's got to be kind of brutal. I mean, you've got Sachsenring coming up on the weekend of the 14th and 15th, and then following that with going to the U.S. for Laguna Seca on the weekend of the 21st and 22nd. So that's
right.
That's quite a schedule.
I think people don't quite realize the transport of the material. Also, Sachsenring will be our fifth race in Europe in a row. So that means we've had five races where we unloaded all of our shipping containers and packed our race trucks full of everything. Then the shipping containers went back to Madrid, and everything's been stored in the race trucks for the last five races. Then at Sachsenring, not only are we going to be preparing for the race, but people like me are going to be trying to figure out, geez, I have two semi-trucks full of stuff, and I've got to get those in the race boxes by Sunday afternoon after the race, Sunday evening, because they're going to be moved out and taken to the airport that night so that they can fly to the U.S. So kind of a logistical nightmare. I don't know. The only way I can put it is it seems like you can move into a new apartment it's a small apartment. You think, oh, this is going to be great. And a month later, you know, 2 months later, you've got all this extra shit, and you're like, holy smokes, where did all this crap come from?
And then you have to put it into an even smaller apartment.
Yeah, I've got to figure out what I'm going to bring. I think it's going to be a small juggling act, because I'm not going to bring everything that's in the semi-trucks. I'm going to think, okay, it's only one race in the U.S., then we come back, and I got to put everything in the truck again for Bruneau. It's going to be interesting, because naturally, you know, this is my first year doing this job, and it's a learning experience all the time. You know, every week I'm lucky enough to learn something every day. So, yeah, looking forward to Sachsenring. I know it's going to be a stressful but a fun event. And then, coming back for the USGP. I've got good riders, good bikes. I hope the Bridgestones are working. I want to have a really successful USGP. You know what? I don't want to take away anything from Nicky Hayden or any of the other Americans trying to win the race, but if any of my guys get a chance to get up there and go for it, then that's why I'm here.
Oh, sure. I mean, and that's totally understandable. I would, you know, if I was in your position, I'd be rooting for the two Alexes as well. And we actually. We always love to see Primack Dantin up there, you know, say, hey, yeah, they're on TV.
It's a weird dark horse kind of thing, isn't it? We definitely get a lot more TV play this year than we ever did, and I think that's because they know that we are more competitive this year, and it is fun to watch when there's a guy that maybe people have counted out for a couple of years or they don't expect very much out of, and then all of a sudden, ooh, you know, there's a curveball in the equation.
Yeah, I think that, you know, rooting for the underdog is not a lot of people do that. I know I do. I always like to see the somebody else do well for a change. You know, you don't want to just see the same guys day in and day out always having it their way. So, no, certainly.
Right.
And you guys have been doing good, both at Donington and at Assen. I mean, like you said, the weather conditions and everything through those kind of races somewhat out of the norm. But, you know, I mean, both riders, I think, either improved or at least hung on to their grid positions. I mean, in Donington, you know.
Oh, yeah. It's actually kind of nice when I study the data, or just the statistics, not the data. You know, I see that on average, you know, Berlos is not the strongest qualifier, but when he has a chance to race, you know, with no crashes and not being taken out, which has happened twice this year, of the seven races he's had with no incidents, he's improved on his grid position anywhere from 3 to 5 positions with every race. And the same goes for Hoffman. He's only moved back a couple of times. He's generally pretty consistent about staying where he gridded or moving up, most notably in France, where he made up, 11 positions, something bizarre.
It was something like that. It was a huge amount.
To get up to the fifth. Yeah. Or 12th to fifth. I don't remember. I'd have to check my files, but yeah, I think one of our main focuses is qualifying better. Because if we can get up there and stay in any of a front lead group, you know, it works out. It works out for my riders. When I think of Mugello, where we podiumed, there was an 8-bike train that was running through that race. You know, and we were 8th. And then we clawed our way up through 3rd by the end of the race. So if we can just hang on to the lead group, I think we've got a great shot, especially because the bike is fast and it's curvy. And, you know, I see Hopkins up there fighting consistently in 3rd and 4th. He's always up there. But if he gets knocked out of the draft, he can't stick with him. And I think with our bike, if we could just get up there and push in the early laps, and hang into that group, and you know, we can obviously stay in a draft. We've got a powerful machine. It's good.
Yeah, it's good. Good stuff. Now, do you think that some of the difficulties that you're seeing, you know, you want to improve your qualifying position? How much do you think is due to tires? I mean, it seems like the Michelins are still on the spot with tires, even though they've been dropping the ball elsewhere. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I think their qualifiers are incredible. When you look at a rider like Rossi, granted, he's, you know, one of the greatest talents that have has ever ridden a bike. But when you see him go out in qualifying and drop a second and a half on everybody, like he did in Jerez, it just blows you away. You go, how is that physically possible to get around a racetrack that fast? Their front qualifier is amazing. Their qualifiers are working great. And, you know, Bridgestone has been trying to up the pace of their development. You know, every two races, it seems like there's new stuff. Or every race, there's new stuff. But every two races, they try and test something. And, you know, we've switched, you know, to using 16-inch rear tires. I know that hit the press a while ago. And while that's been good in certain respects, other riders that, you know, maybe haven't used a 16-inch before, it's pretty different because maybe the tire weighs the same, but the gyroscopic force of having a smaller rim and a bigger meat of rubber, you know, it affects the suspension. It affects how the bike reacts when you give it gas. There's a lot of little changes to make that people don't really see. You know, so it's always important to remember that the bikes are constantly changing and evolving.
Oh, sure. But one question I did want to ask, and this is another one that I picked up off one of the commentaries, and I mentioned it to you in an email, and you kind of went, why the hell would they do that? But Bridgestone testing wet, you know, full wet tires on a dry track. And in the commentary, it was suggested that this is to sort of see if to get some improvements out of the wet when you got a drying track to get some improvements out of the wet tire. Had you heard anything along those lines, or is that smoke? Or
I had not heard so much about those things. It brings up an interesting point that I wanted to share with everybody, in that I've always maintained that adaptability is key to being successful in this series, because the bike is changing, the tires change. I mean, the bike changes so much from the first lap to the last lap, just with fuel load. You really need to be able to change and ride around problems and you know, adapt to keep going fast lap after lap. And Donington's a perfect example of a racetrack that dried out from a really miserable start, where everything was wet and there was standing water, to having a completely dry line in the second half of the race. The tires were really squirming. I mean, I touched my tires when my bikes came in after the race, and I don't think I could have ridden on those tires personally on any bike. And Michelin obviously had their problems. I heard about some of their tires coming apart toward the latter part of that race just due to heat, because that's in Donington we were running a really soft compound. Everybody was running as soft as you could get because the track temperature was so cold and the conditions were so bad. When the track went to dry, the coefficient of friction goes up so much that things get really hot, and that's what destroys the carcass and really compromises the tire. What's the most important thing that I wanted to say about that was there are riders that don't really change anything in their bike setup when they go to a rain condition. They say, okay, put the rain tires on, but don't really touch anything else on the bike.
Really?
And those are the guys with a really good feel. They can go out there and they can do that, whereas other riders will change the front suspension. They'll change everything on the bike, and then it becomes a rain bike, and they can only ride it in the rain. And then when the track dries out, then they really struggle because the bike is not able to run in the dry. All of a sudden, you've got such soft springs in the front end. When you hit the brake, you're going all the way to the bump stops, you know, or if you're leaned over in a high-speed corner, your suspension is compressed and you're bouncing off the bump stops. The suspension's not helping you at all. And then all the stress and the G-force is on the rubber. So it's a neat balance to see how riders can change and react to a condition shift like that, from full wet to full dry, like we had at Donington.
Right.
I don't know if Bridgestone has tested their wets in the full dry condition. They definitely got enough data on it after Donington.
Yeah.
But there's so much more to racing a bike than just the rubber. I mean, rubber's the most important thing, and then after that, everything else plays a big part.
This season as a whole has been so wet that it's, It's just, I mean, I'm sure that this wet tires are getting all kinds of, you know, improvements and data and whatnot like that. I mean,
yeah, I would agree. I mean, to me, it hasn't been a super wet season. I mean, it's just been a season. We had wet conditions last year. I think 6 out of the first 7 races had a wet session at some point, whether it was a pre-practice or over qualifying. Maybe the races weren't necessarily wet. But weather's been a factor every year. And you know, we just deal with it and just get to the next session and get to the qualifying and the race. And we just have to take it in stride now because it's one of the few things we really don't have any control over.
Yeah, and speaking of weather, did you guys ever get your weather station back or replace it for here that was stolen?
Not yet.
No, so you're still relying on the internet?
Yay! No, I mean, other people have weather stations too. Bridgestone has their own equipment, their own data that they share with us. They say, hey, we think it's going to be like this, and obviously they need to be on top of it more than anybody else because they bring their tires in from Japan, so they have to plan well in advance. For weather conditions, all types of weather conditions.
Right.
I'm just hoping Laguna's not as hot this year.
Yeah.
If I sunburn my head.
That was one thing when I was reading about it, and you know, I was in Gulfport, Mississippi, which was its own miserable hellhole of weather. And I, but just reading the thing, it's like it was 105 or 107 or something like that at Laguna, and it's like, oh my God. It's. So moving on, more chatter. What do you got? Let's see. Coming up, you got Sachsenring again, like I said, and Laguna Seca. You mentioned a little bit about some of your expectations for Sachsenring. Anything more? Any more sort of specifics of what we might be seeing or what's going to be happening?
Well, it seems like a lot of people have targeted Brno once again as the true midpoint of the season because it's after the summer break and the factory and everyone else has a chance to recharge and come up with new stuff. Honda's allegedly coming out with the evolution of their machine to take it to the next level. And I'm sure Ducati and Yamaha and everyone else are targeting Brno also as a place to introduce new things because we test in Brno after the race. So it's our next available testing time. That's not a race condition. I don't know. My primary thoughts are making it through Sachsenring and Laguna Seca.
Yeah.
As far as my job, because I know, you know, there's a little bit of a break and I can restock for Brno, but just making sure I can get through these next two races are important to me, especially because Sachsenring is a tricky track. You've got a lot of downhill and cambered turns, and physically it's an extremely demanding circuit. It puts a lot of stress on the front tire. It's a tricky track, and you know, you've got real high speed sections. You've got that bizarre last corner up here to the left, where it's really easy to lose a lot of time or block pass and you know, the race has been decided in that last corner for years. So first, I just want to think about Sachsenring and how I'm going to pack all my stuff to get to Laguna Seca. And then on a personal note, I'm thinking, well, geez, I'm going to be out of my house for 2 weeks, and I'm going to try and stay in California for a week after the race. Just got to prepare that extra material, and are my bags going to be light enough to get on the airplane? Because I have a very low kilo limit when I fly in economy for how heavy my bags can be.
Sure.
And it's just, I don't know. I think about work so much that my personal life has to take a back seat, and then I go, holy smokes, I'm going to be back in California. I got to hook up with this guy. I got something for this guy. I just want to eat and drink. If I could just sit in Cupertino for 4 hours in the afternoon and just chill, and I want to get on a motorcycle and ride through Santa Cruz and so on and so forth. I got all these things I want to do, but not that much time because I'm still going to be working every day. As long as I can access the internet, you know, I can work. Then I just found out that I had requested to stay in Japan after the Motegi race like I did last year to kind of absorb more of that culture and just take a mini break, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know exactly how the date came about, but it appears that I'm going to be doing Estoril, then immediately flying to Japan for a week, and then staying in Japan for 2 weeks after the race, and then flying direct to Phillip Island.
Oh, wow.
And I think after Phillip Island is Malaysia, so I'm scratching my head going, wait a minute, did I just sign up to be out of my house for 6 or 7 weeks?
It sounds that way.
yeah, and I just go, oh, man, that's going to be a... If I think Laguna is going to be tricky to take care of myself, Japan's going to be that much worse. Fortunately, I have some friends over there. I think my friends from China are going to swing by the race and stay a week in Japan just to kind of do the same thing I'm doing. And there are some people from Barf out there that I hope to stay with. And, you know, it's always a freaky deal. Like, I've met so many great people, and, you know, they each get a small snapshot of my life. Like, well, okay, we're going to spend 6 hours with Liam, and wow, the guy is really random, or, you know, he's really stressed out or whatever. I mean, it's a little different. I try and maintain like an even, keep everything on an even level. But, you know, sometimes people see me and they can't believe, wow, this is the guy that does that. Or, you know, and I just think, wow, do these people really know me, or do they know me from the website online, or just listening to MotoGPOD? And it's neat. It's neat, but, you know, I just wish I had more time. And it always boils down to time.
Yes.
Everything.
Oh, man. I preaching to the choir on that one. But I think with your stuff, the things you got going on, it's even sometimes more impressive the amount of effort you put into your website and these calls. I mean, we've been talking here for well over an hour, and of only recording.
Well, the work they finished in Italy about this time, and I'm going to go spend a couple hours on the internet tonight. The cafe internet is still down at my house, so I've been forced to leave my house and then come back and leave and come back, and it hasn't been cool. I'll just put it that way. So
No.
Big thumbs up to my internet company here in Spain for not taking care of me.
Yeah. Kudos to them. And so none of your neighbors have open wireless or something you can just steal, huh?
No, it's not locked. I'm sure there's a way I could break that code, but I don't like to do illegal things.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if it's a, you know.
More technical questions. I remember you saying that you wanted to have some technical info, and all right, here's some technical info. Marco Melandri wears really bright orange custom shoes. I've never seen anything like them. I think they're Nikes or some other fancy running shoe. But I swear you could take them off his feet and land a plane on an aircraft carrier with them.
These are his regular civilian shoes you're talking about that he wears every day?
Yeah, that he wears around around the paddock. And I just go, man, those are bright. What else is technical?
Yeah, that's might not be the technical that we're thinking of, but it's a good tidbit.
All right, here's another technical thing. Generally, there are bathrooms at every racetrack we go to. Germany's bathroom's pretty good. I remember the paper was of a decent quality. Same thing with England. Here's a great Donington story. I was in the bathroom, in the stall, and it was really crowded because there were only three stalls in the paddock near where our trucks were based, and it was a huge crowd. It was raining outside, so everybody was crammed in there, all these British people and team people, different teams. And as I'm getting up, I hear this gigantic slamming of the door, bam, 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 you know, like somebody was trying to kick my door down. And I just thought, well, that's mighty odd. It was like the first thing that came to my mind, like, bizarre, you know, hang on a minute. And I go to open the door, and as I try to open the door, it's blocked. And then I hear this giant commotion outside. A boy had had maybe an epileptic seizure or some form of seizure and fallen against my door.
Oh, wow.
So he's laying on the ground. Ian Wheeler, the communications guy from Kawasaki, jumped into action and was like, okay, check his eyes, make sure he hasn't swallowed his tongue, prop his head. You know, I went through the full routine, making sure this kid was okay. And the kid came to almost immediately, and they were like, what's your name? Who are you with? He said he was with his father. Some other team guy, I think from Suzuki, ran outside and started yelling the father's name. Is there a so-and-so here? And they brought the father in. And you know, a couple minutes later, the kid finally got up, and they went to the clinic immobile, and at that time, I could leave the stall because the door was not blocked anymore.
Uh-huh.
But it just was really great to see how it didn't matter, you know, if you were on a team or not on a team or whatever, but the guys reacted really well and really professionally and took care of it. And that was really cool. I had a neat talk with Ian Wheeler from Kawasaki about that afterwards because he was great. I mean, it was like he was an EMT or something. He just knew immediately what to do and how to do it, and it was great.
That is kind of cool.
Oh, but yeah, technically. I wanted to get back to technical issues.
Yes, technical.
So Mugello, beautiful Italian racetrack, was you know, a Ferrari test track before the motorcycles came, and they've got neat facilities, and you go into the little bathroom, there's a bathroom inside of each garage, each paddock garage, but it's one of those things where there's a hole in the ground,
uh-huh.
And because of an old knee injury, I can't use them. So I scoured the entire place, and I found an actual toilet with a seat, and it was upstairs in between the media center and some of the other offices in the complex, the paddock complex, and it was a handicap restroom, the only place that had a seat. And I was like, oh, praise Jesus. You know, I got a bathroom with a seat in Italy. This is fantastic. So I go up there, and there's no lock on the door. And everyone else that was in needed this bathroom. So I had to play guard duty with John Hopkins' girlfriend standing out of the door, you know, making sure that nobody would go in when she or her friend were in the bathroom. And then I went in there, and it was like, geez, I hope nobody opens the door. Like, just anyway, if you're in Mugello, it's upstairs, and there's no lock on the door.
These are the stories that you'll only hear on MotoGPOD, I think. The technical
stories.
You
want to know the real life behind what it's like to travel with the MotoGP series? This is it.
This is true.
It's always a struggle with the bathrooms.
Yeah.
What else is cool? Hopper's girlfriend, Ashley, was pretty nice, actually, and friendly.
Have you talked to her before, or was that sort of your first meeting there guarding the bathroom?
We'd seen each other in the paddock every race because, you know, sometimes I've been next to Suzuki and whatnot, and I say hi to John.
Mm-hmm.
But this was our first chance to kind of catch up and introduce and say, like, hey, how's it going? You got to use the bathroom, too. Cool, me too. All right. You know, one of those odd, like, great. And let's see, what else is cool?
Do we want to continue on the bathroom theme,
it.
Or do you want to throw out some other ideas?
That was just a humorous little sidetrack.
Oh, no, actually, it was, you know, I'm going to leave it in. It was good. A couple of years ago when I did a Laguna follow-up, I went on at great length about the bathrooms at Laguna Seca in 2005 for the regular unwashed public like ourselves, and that was horrible. But moving on. Let's see, technically wise, one question I did get, and this goes back to tires. And we've talked about this before, but it was a long time ago. We've got a lot of new people, and it keeps coming up because I think it's an urban legend. It's helium in the tires to make the motorcycle lighter. And I'm pretty sure that, yeah, that it's a completely urban legend. But I do know that people occasionally run nitrogen in their tires. But I don't think
and
that's...
And why not?
Let's say again.
Nitrogen is the most common element.
This is true.
In our atmosphere.
Yeah, actually, so when you're running just straight air, it's mostly nitrogen anyway. But
that's right. Everyone fills their tires with nitrogen at the gas station. No, I think I can put this to rest. Speaking about tires, it's critical, based on the rubber compound of the tire, you know, obviously there are different compounds, and they're going to heat at different rates. They're going to maintain their heat at different rates. But how they react with the air mixture that's inside the tire is very important. And this is true across all the brands, Dunlop, Bridgestone, and Yamaha. What they fill the tires with is a mixture of different gases, whether it's nitrogen, argon, who knows, helium could be a factor. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a really closely guarded secret because each mixture of air that they put into the tire is supposed to work differently with each compound of rubber that the tire is made out of, so that maybe it goes out on a hot day on a hot racetrack and then the air is going to react with the rubber and it's going to maintain a more constant temperature for the carcass, or maybe they They can go out on the same tire, but they'll fill it with a different mixture of gases, and it's going to react differently after five laps, or it'll react differently initially. These are all things that you really can't get data from, you know, from a sensor, or you can't check the suspension and say, okay, this is happening. It's not as obvious a thing to tell, and that's why it's so critical to have clear rider feedback. If they say, okay, we're testing tires today, we're going to test all these tires, for a rider to be able to pick out and point and say, okay, this was good, this was bad, this was like this, this one was sliding out of three, this one was doing that. That stuff is what really helps the tire manufacturers go back and they reread everything and they go, okay, obviously this worked well with this style and this rider, and the general consensus from the riders was this one worked better. You know, and then they'll work towards that direction. But as to whether they fill tires with helium to make the bikes lighter, complete urban myth.
Yes.
and really humorous. I mean, when you asked me that before, I thought it was a technical thing. Like, oh, yeah, I guess helium could react, you know, in a certain way and in combination with other gases.
I think that you'd have a lot of
a lighter, geez.
With helium, it'd be like a, you know, a helium balloon, when you get a kid's balloon and it deflates after a day and it's just kind of bobbling around on the floor, because helium is so small, it goes through the surface of the balloon. And I mean, you're going to get that same effect on a tire, enough that it would be bad, I would think. So it's just,
Well, you got to figure how many layers there are in a tire compared to how thin a balloon is.
Oh, sure. You know, I understand that, but you also have to figure that basically any solid object that we look at is still largely composed of empty space between, you know, atoms. So, I wouldn't, I don't know. What I had always sort of heard and was under the impression of was that whatever they filled the tires with had to be extremely dry. But hearing your, that they're basically sort of putting in this custom cocktail of different types of gases, that's really interesting. That's super neat. And I had no idea. I thought they were using straight air that was just, you know, as dehumidified as they could get it.
Well, maybe they are. I don't know.
I thought you just told us that they were using all kinds of special stuff. But, But yeah, again, like you said,
I will admit or deny nothing.
Ah, there we go.
No, but it is true that there are different mixtures that work better and work worse depending on the tire, and, you know, depending on the track surface and depending on the temperature of things. I mean, there's so many factors that go into it. It's quite possibly one of the most fascinating areas of development as far as motorcycles.
Oh, I agree. And tires are always everything about tires is very much a black art of, you know, and closely guarded secrets half the time, so you don't know what the hell's going on anyway.
Right. Anything else technical?
What have I got? Let's see. I had some notes. I was coming up dry on the stuff that I thought you would be able to sort of answer. You know, the things that you could tell us that would be, you know, where you're not going to get in trouble for giving away the secrets or something. But one thing. Oh, there was a feature on MotoGP.com, and I talked about it in my last show with Shoei doing these cool little quick release cheek pad helmet thing, and there was these two little red pull tabs underneath the helmet, and just kind of snapped the cheek pads out, and that way they could take the helmet off the injured rider if a rider was injured without moving his neck around too much. And is this something you're seeing on all the helmets, or is it just a Shoei thing, or what?
I think at the moment it's a Shoei thing, because of the AGV and the Suomi that my riders are using, I haven't noticed anything out of the ordinary.
Right, and they haven't told you. I mean, I would think this is something that they would have, you know, because trained you about if all else fails, so.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything out of the ordinary. I know Alpine Stars is working on a neck brace, similar to the layout brace they're using in motocross right now, and they're testing it with a young rider in the MotoGP Academy, Jiggy Dog from Washington. That's a neat idea, good safety feature.
Yeah. What else you got going on?
I know that Kawasaki works a lot because Randy crashes a lot. I'm friends with the parts guy from Kawasaki.
Uh-huh.
There's a weird fraternity of parts people, I think, because we all have completely different stresses than a mechanic or a rider. You know, So we all look at each other, you know, across the back of our trucks, like, okay, how's it going, Rob? How's it going, Rich? How's it going, David? You know, we all know one another. And it's this neat fraternity, and whatever Kawasaki comes up, we just kind of shake our heads like, poor Rob. That guy works really hard. Because it's a lot. You know, every time the bike crashes and you replace all the pieces, it's not like you just open a drawer and the stuff is there. You got to say, oh, I need to order this in advance in case of the crash, or you got to track each piece that comes off the bike or the pieces you lost in a crash. And, you know, it's a big swirl, like the butterfly wings flapping in the desert, and all of a sudden it's a hurricane or a tornado somewhere else. Like, it's a weird, you know, little things just, they grow exponentially.
Sure, sure. Interesting. When you talk about tracking all those parts and everything, I guess, are you using computerized inventory systems, or is it still just running around with clipboards, or how are you doing that?
No, it is all via computer.
Yeah.
However, I am looking to create a new system for 2008. So hopefully I run into some big inventory type nerds in California. Because I'll confess, the PC is my weak point. I understand how to use one, and I can physically use one, but I've been using Macintosh for so long and doing my own system of work, that for me to adapt to the PC earlier this year, it took a little bit of doing. And now that I seem to have a handle on it, I keep seeing all these different ways that I can improve it. And I go, well, geez, is it a system thing, or is it just that I don't have the right program for this, or enough experience with the programs that PC people use to track inventory? I wish I had a way to improve upon that. So I hope to be able to meet with some people in California, because it's difficult to try and explain everything you want to the Italians, because they're constrained to use the system that works with their factory and their invoicing accounting system. And, you know, they're a big place. They have a big structure, and they can't just say, okay, we're going to change to this.
Right.
Impossible. Right. But for me, because I'm with the privateer team, I could do anything I wanted, as long as at the end of the day I sent them back a file that looked like their files.
Right.
But yeah, I'm always interested in improving the efficiency of things.
Well, yeah, if anywhere is the place to
by computer.
Yeah, and if anywhere is the place to meet somebody, I think Laguna Seca actually would be a real good opportunity. So listeners out there, I know a lot of you are involved in the IT industry. Hear that? Liam's calling for help.
That's right. IT people, I'll be in Silicon Valley. Maybe for the week after the race. I don't know if I'm going to get down to Los Angeles or not, because my father and my brother are living down there, and I wanted to try and see them this year. But if that doesn't work out, then I'll be in the Bay Area trying to learn more about computers.
Cool deal. But, well, all right, Liam, it's been about 45 minutes, and it's been an excellent call. I love the bathroom stories. But I guess probably the next time that I actually talk to you will be at Laguna face-to-face, which will be our
I'll meet you in the bathroom.
Yeah, it'll be our first face-to-face. So I'm really looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to meeting MotoGPOD listeners. I'm looking forward to seeing you and just the whole nine yards, and that's going to be a great time. And until then... hey, thanks a lot. Really do
Let's
appreciate
it. Let's try and do a quick call sometime in Sachsenring, or
we can.
So we can
you're only,
put
are you
some
have
more
time?
Material out for Laguna Seca. I'd like to be able to say at some point, hey, meet me here, or any MotoGPOD listeners, if you're in the area, I will be here on Friday night or whatever.
Okay. Will you have time between, because I was thinking that I didn't want to bother you between Sachsenring and Laguna Seca just because you're super busy. But yeah, let me know when, you know, give me a time, and we'll do a super quick call and all of that. And that'd be cool.
Perfect.
Right on.
Yay! Yeah. Coming back home.
Well, all right. Well, thanks again. And we will talk to you later, Liam.
All right. Take care, Bob. And thanks for the call. I hope everyone gets a kick out of it. You know, it was weird at Donington. After the race, I guess we raced a little bit early. We didn't pack up our garage immediately. We went to go eat lunch because we weren't able to eat lunch before the race. Uh-huh. And as I was walking back to my garage, this gentleman in his 50s and leathers like stopped me, and he's like, "Hey, I listen to you on MotoGPOD, and I've heard you on Rumblestrip Radio, and da-da-da-da. I just wanted to say hi." And I was like, "All right, cool.
That's
like,
cool.
Nice to meet you." And I wish I had more time, but at that point, my team was like, "Okay, as soon as lunch is finished, we're going to pack the trucks, and they got to drive tonight."
Yeah.
To get to Assen, because Assen was on Saturday and not Sunday. So I didn't really have a chance to spend any time with him, but he emailed me the following week. And it was really, really cool. It was really nice to get that email. So any MotoGPOD listeners out there, anytime you see me, just say hi. I mean, it's really cool for me, and if I have a chance to speak with you, I'm happy to do so.
Cool deal. Thanks a lot, Liam. We will put your smiling face maybe up on the website or whatever, and if all else fails, you can see it at MotoLiam.com, which is Liam's official website, and I was sticking there. I kept thinking MotoGP, but MotoLiam.com is Liam's official website, and let's see it. And now we really got to go. And so,
all right.
Thanks a lot, Liam. We'll talk to you later.
Okay. Bye, Bob.
All right. Thanks again to Liam for taking the time on the phone with us there. It's always great to talk to him. He always makes a very entertaining phone call. I hope you enjoyed the show. I thank you very much again for downloading it. Hope I didn't forget anything. And if I did, well, I will cover it next week. But we've got our Laguna Seca round coming up very, very shortly right here after Saxon Ring. Don't forget, I am going to be there. And Jules is going to be there. We're going to be having a great old time. And basically, I'll be the guy wearing the MotoGPOD t-shirt walking around. You'll find me in, let's see, Saturday. I'm going to be there Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I'm just doing my own thing, watching whatever, finding when they're out on the track for the practice sessions and the qualifying for AMA and all that sort of thing. I'll be at a variety of different places around the track Saturday. I have grandstand seats, not necessarily that I'm going to be planted in those seats the entire time, but I have grandstand seats both in section 4B and 11B on Saturday. So I'll kind of be jumping around back and forth between those and between, going up to the top of the corkscrew or whatever, you'll find me around. And then on Sunday for actual race day, again, I have grandstand seats in section 4B, row 2, good seats I got. I'm kind of looking forward to that. Again, not going to be camped out in those grandstand seats. I don't like to just go there and sit for all day long. So I'll be walking around and just look around for me. MotoGPOD t-shirt on. I've got blonde hair. I'll be wearing, shorts and a scrungy-looking t-shirt. And you might find me in line at the beer stand. You might find me in the grandstand. You might find me wandering around. Whatever. And I was camping down at the archery campgrounds in the beautiful scenic archery campgrounds of lovely Laguna Seca fame. And so whatever. Drop on by. Say hello. Stop me. Whatever. Anybody you see wearing a MotoGPOD t-shirt, say, "Hey, are you Bob?" And as soon as I talk, you might notice or not. Whatever, hope to see you there. I do appreciate you downloading the show, like I said. And until next week, we are out. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGPOD isn't affiliated with any of them.